American people expect us to do ours as well. Congress needs to quit talking about supporting the troops and put money where our mouths seem to be. Nathan Bedford Forrest, successful Confederate general, said it best about winning and victory and the means to do so. He said, get there firstest with the mostest. Congress needs to send the generals the mostest, Mr. Speaker. Need to send equipment and personnel that is needed. Doing this will help our mission in spite of the congressional surrender group's desire to retreat.
Bedford Forrest said it best. It's quite interesting that this is the slob that old Ted Poe would quote, the successful Confederate general. It's interesting that this quote-unquote successful Confederate general, after his career ended, he founded the white terrorist organization known as the Ku Klux Klan. Ain't this about nothing? This clown representative Ted Poe quoting Nathan Ku Kluxer on the House floor like he's a hero. Wait a minute. This is the real America. Bedford and the Klan are heroes. It's time we put a slave antidote to this madness. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this. One Berkeley, freakradio.org in Santa Cruz with Skid, 96.3, 107.5. Check out savagejustice.blogspot.com and propagandapress.org. Tune in to radioforall.net, the universe. Tonight, we're going into an aspect of some traditional ways of American life, concerning some colored bullets and white bullets. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Thank you.
Ajax, Louisiana. Easter Sunday, April 13th, 1873. The Negroes had been in control of the village for 3 weeks now, and it was plain that something terrible was going to happen. Their leaders had left for New Orleans on Wednesday to try to get help, meaning they hoped a detachment of police or, even better, federal troops who would come to protect the people in the village. The white militia were encamped out in the countryside a few miles away, and every day it was being reinforced with volunteers, mostly Confederate veterans, who had heard the whites' call for help, who had taken their shotguns and six-shooters and muskets and Springfield rifles from the Civil War down from the wall and saddled up their horses, and who had come to Colfax to fight for white supremacy. The Negroes, some of them at least, had guns too, Enfield rifles shipped up from New Orleans in boxes, and an assortment of lesser firearms. But now, by now, there were many more people than guns to go around. Hundreds of people, including women and children, who had come to Colfax because they feared the whites bursting into their homes and killing them. The Negro headquarters was the county courthouse, a two-story converted stable from a sugarcane plantation. At a short distance from it, they had dug rudimentary breastwork manned by sentries to starve off the inevitable attack. All around, the Negroes from the countryside were camped out. Deeply lodged in the consciousness of the South was the ever-present possibility of a race war in which each side's version, it would be mercilessly slaughtered by the other. If the anticipated deaths themselves were not horrible enough, unspeakable atrocities would make them more so. Now the inevitable was about to happen, and the cause was something that registered in that time and place as being literally a matter of life and death, politics. The Civil War was not 10 years in past. The Deep South was still in a raw condition, not far removed from war. The two political parties and the two races were still violently opposed to each other. The great national question the war had raised had by no means been settled. They were going to be settled now, with profound and lasting consequences for the whole United States. In places like rural Louisiana, by hard men with intensely local concerns, through the means of an armed struggle that, for all the potency of the load of racial fantasies it carried, was really about who could vote and hold government office. This is an excerpt from Nicholas Lemann's redemption book, The Last Battle of the Civil War. We're going to go into some of these aspects in this Beyond the Shadow segment called Reconstruction's End, The Terrorist Gang, Colored Bullets, White Bullets, and explore the dynamic of the beginning and end of the Reconstruction period. Continuing, Colfax, Louisiana was not really a town. It was more a settlement containing just five or six structures. And even then, it had its particular status. Politically, Colfax was part of an experiment, a new Louisiana that could resemble the abolitionist pre-war dreams of how the South should be after its defeat in the Civil War. In 1868, a racially integrated black and tan Republican state legislator had created a new parish along the north bank of the Red River, drawing its boundaries so as to ensure that its local government would be Republican thanks to a Negro population majority. The parish was named Grant after the Republican President of the United States, Ulysses S. Grant, and its seat was named Colfax after the Republican Vice President, Schuester Colfax. To most local whites, these were unpleasantly Renaissance names. Only a decade earlier, federal troops under General Grant's ultimate command, he was not far away in Mississippi, had, as one white man from Colfax later remembered it, ravaged, quote unquote, the Red River country using techniques taught them by the same, quote, experts in extermination, unquote. That Grant's leading subordinate, General William Sherman, later used in his notoriously destructive march through Georgia, quote, if it were in my power, I would as soon as possible change the name of Grant Paris to Lee and the site of her dispensatory of justice to Davis, unquote. Another white resident asserted, referring to the Confederate's leading general and its president. On Easter Sunday, 1873, Louisiana was in a state of low-grade warfare. In 1872, while President Grant was being reelected in a landslide, Louisiana had a close and corrupt election. Both sides claimed victory, and now the state had two governors and two state legislators, one Democrat, one Republican. A month after the election, federal troops dispatched by President Grant arrived in New Orleans, took control of the state house, expelled the Democratic government, and installed the Republicans. Grant's parish, appropriately enough, given the condition of the state, had two political leaders, one from each party, each claiming control over the local police function. The Republican, a black Union veteran born a slave named William Ward, the Democrat, a white Confederate veteran named Christopher Columbus Nash, quote, in his face he bears the indications of all the worst qualities of his race and none of the better, unquote. A white organization later wrote about Ward, and to judge by the one surviving photograph of Nash, he was a pretty rough character too, with a full untrimmed black beard and close-set piercing eyes. Both men had long, harsh experiences during the Civil War, extensive combat, injury, and imprisonment. They had come separately, of course, to the Red River County after the war because they saw opportunity, specifically political opportunity. One evening in 1871, Columbus Nash, then deputy sheriff of Grant Parish, led a mob of 50 armed white men to a house outside Colfax where two black Republican office holders were living. The white men set the house on fire and shot the Negroes when they emerged. One of them survived by playing dead until the whites had left and then escaping. Legally, this incident fell under the category of law enforcement rather than crime, and Nash continued to serve as sheriff. William Ward was said to have killed a white man, or maybe two, that same year, though unlike the incident involving Nash, it was more a popular legend than a proven fact. In the version of the story most often told by the white people in Colfax, Ward had taken his victim onto the river in a skiff, hacked him to pieces with a hatchet, and dumped his remains overboard. When the Republicans got the upper hand in New Orleans at the outset of 1873, thanks to the help of the U.S. Army, both Nash and Ward made it known that they wanted to be put in political authority in Grant Parish. The Republican governor, William Pitt Kellogg, vacillated, which was the worst thing he could do for the cause of stability in Grant Parish, and then appointed Ward's Republican forces. A meeting was held at the governor's office in New Orleans in March, with Ward, one of his lieutenants, and two Democrats allied with Columbus Nash. In the presence of the governor, the two sides started arguing, and one of the Democrats warned that if Nash was not made sheriff, there would be bloodshed. Ward returned to Colfax, called together his Republican political allies, and unable to effect a peaceful transition of power because the Democrats wouldn't permit it, broke into the courthouse at night and took over the machinery of Paris government such as it was. To the whites, this was intolerable. They could not accept Negro rule in Colfax. With the free slave plantation hand majority having legal authority over their former masters. In fact, from the white's perspective, the situation hadn't been tolerable for quite some time, probably since anti-slavery sentiment had become an important force in national politics years before the Civil War began. Just after the war, white Louisianans had been able to establish firm political control over the state. Then, from 1868 to 1872, Louisiana had been ruled by a biracial, moderate, and corrupt Republican regime, and so had Grant Parish. Whether that kind of government would have lasted is impossible to say, because it didn't last. But even before a blacker, more radical version of the Republican Party took power, whites in Grant Parish felt they were living in an upside-down nightmare world. In a deep rural, almost frontier culture, where most communication was by word of mouth, where they were greatly outnumbered, and where racial issues carried the heaviest possible economic, political, and psychological load, rumors and myths were rife, and they mattered just about as much as reality. Mattered enough anyway to determine what people thought and did. Let me stop for a second. This aspect deals with the dilemma that black people found themselves in after the Civil War ended and the establishment of Reconstruction, which actually started to form even before the Civil War ended, because as whites started to flee certain areas in the South, especially the landowners, blacks were starting to get that land temporarily. I'll get more into that later on. But concerning how racial issues carried the heaviest possible economic, political, and psychological load, it's interesting, but in many ways it's beyond that, because the construct of whiteness itself is an elite construct. It's an elite economic construct, a social construct, political, cultural, patriarchal, psychological, and a nationalistic construct within the given country, and in this case, America. You can't explain American identity without explaining and seeing and understanding white identity as it was formed within that process. And the right for America to expand indiscriminately over other human beings' territory, i.e. Native Aboriginals, and the justification of their extermination, the theft of other regions' land, i.e. Mexico, and the enslavement and bondage of other human beings, was not only a national concurrence, but it coincided with the growth in identity of whiteness within America. So those two went hand in hand. So when you often talk about the American idea and its righteousness and supremacist beliefs about itself, it coincides with the supremacist beliefs of the elites who created whiteness and those who buy into the whiteness, whether they have two cents or not, who also follow that script. This is why when you often hear people talk about there's no greater place than America, many of whom have never even stepped outside of these borders, what in many ways they're also saying is that there's nothing really greater than white Americans. So they're not only talking about the nation state, they're talking about themselves as white people within the given society. Now, black people's political participation in the body politics created a radical, i.e. humanization of the social, political, economic issues. It challenged the slaveocracy's class vision of having absolute dominance post the Civil War years, a war that was essentially fought over slavery. During that time, the lines were extremely, extremely clear. The Democrats were the white party, mainly the white party of the South, and they represented the plantation class elite capitalists, the planters, the slaveocracy. The Republicans represented the industrial class of the North, the railroad, the bankers, steel. Blacks became a political factor because of the politics of slavery and the post-Civil War configuration that became a component of power for Republicans, as they now had with the rights of black people to vote, more voting power and influence in the southern regions. Because in many regions in the South, like in Mississippi, the blacks were the majority. And quite naturally, since the Republicans had been on the side of the Union, that had been part of the backbone of crushing chattel slavery. Now, in reality, it was for their own ends and means. It wasn't really about black people per se. But quite naturally, black people would take this opportunity to align themselves and try to raise their own human condition in a situation where they now had the right to ascertain certain basic rights, which could directly lead to more economic stability and autonomy. Back then, voting and participation in politics was a very local level, on a very local level, that you can see the benefits. You could see schools immediately be built and so on and so forth by having elected officials in your town that were sympathetic towards your condition. So, of course, for a black population, much of which was just emerging out of slavery, the opportunity was gold, even though, as we'll see, it was a tainted piece of gold. Now, there was an author named Kate Grant. She came from a white family that owned a plantation. She had written a novel called The Blue and Gray, also called The Battle of Colfax, a woman's tribute and admiration to the heroes of Grant and her sister parishes who fought so violently side by side with Sheriff C.C. Nash. The Colfax massacre set off a wave and a chain of this type of violent reaction. And this helps kind of outline not only the terrorist actions and tactics that would be part of the norm to battle Reconstruction, but some of the mindset, as I was outlining about the construct of whiteness. This Kate Grant, as I noted, she stated this was, quote, a woman's tribute, quote unquote. But what she really meant was a white woman's tribute to the white terrorists' tactics employed for white supremacy. She was, of course, not concerned about black women, and she and others saw their lot other women, white women, saw their lot as white people, i.e. supreme women, and that overrode everything else. Because during that time, women didn't have the right to vote. So it wasn't like by the terrorist tactics that were taking place by white men, allied with white women and propagandists like herself, that white women were going to get more basic rights. They were still going to be in the particular status outlined by elite white males. So I point this out to illuminate the dynamics and construct once again of how whiteness overrode and overrides all else within the body politics. Now, continuing with redemption. Negroes in the view of From Blue to Gray, Grant's book, are a simple people who thrive under conditions of forced labor and who under other conditions deteriorate into idleness or worse, violent rage at whites. Political activity, never the Negro's own idea or preference, but instead something planted in their malleable minds by scheming, self-interested whites, is the prime force pushing them away from work and to mischief. In the first years after emancipation in 1863 and the ratification in 1870 of the 15th Amendment, which gave Negroes the right to vote, this was not a terrible problem in Grant Parish, according to Kate Grant. Quote, when the political fever had spent its force, when the simple Negro had been saturated with the pomp and excitement of mass meetings, barbecues, and the rest of the ridiculous hubbub, he will go back to his calm, and he will work better, if possible, than before because of having learned the true nature of the men who picked him up and dropped him at will. Old habits of industry will reassert themselves, unquote. But then Republicanism took a more ominous turn. Quote, strange white men appeared in the quarters upon whose countenance the brand of villainy was stamped. These tools of radicalism sought the companionship of the black, ate with them, drank with them, lived with them on terms of perfect equality, embraced them also in the fullness of their newborn affection. In a word, they completely warmed themselves into the confidence of the unsuspecting dupes. The rascals gloried in their deception, unquote. After the 1872 election, when these radicals took over the local Republican Party, quote, the Negroes quit work, formed rights societies to protest against the violence done their color on the other side, and with sullen looks and muttering, showed their poison had done its work, unquote. Now, let me stop right there for a sec. See, this shows the particular contempt and mentality of individuals like this. You know, black people who are constantly being slaughtered, who had been through the chattel slave period, and who now started to ascertain some political influence and power, wanted some kind of protection, and protested against the violence and violation done to them as a people. But now, all of a sudden, this is seen as a people being unsuspecting dupes, and that these simple Negroes were being manipulated. And now, all of a sudden, it showed the poison that was running basically through their veins by being influenced in this matter. It just outlines the other contempt that many have for the basics of black humanity it just doesn't exist in these people's minds. It doesn't matter. And one of the reoccurring issues and dynamics that is at the backbone of this conflict, when you get beyond the rhetoric of black people basically were happy on the plantation until, you know, some outsiders came in and started to influence them, is that black people have historically organized whenever possible to try to ascertain basic human rights. In Florida, at an AME church in the 1920s, this was stated by black Floridians, quote, "Whereas labor is the basis of all wealth, and wealth is an absolute necessity of civilized society and peaceful commission of society and security of life and property, a jealous regard for the rights of labor and among the imperative duties for a well-ordered government, the resolve by the Convention of Ministries and Laymen of the African Methodist Episcopal Church in Florida, that we congratulate our people upon the rapid progress they have made in the past 6 years and upon the increase of mixed industry homesteads and small farms in opposition to the ruinous plantation system. We proudly point to the facts as repudiation of our natural-born enemies, the Democrats, that the freemen do not work," unquote. Now, this outlines that the conflict that black people saw themselves in, and saw that the plantation system was a ruinous system, and that they needed education, schooling, a development of their own societies, autonomy, land, etc., etc. But also the outlining of the jealous regards of the rights of the labor. What basically black people were saying was that those who toiled the land, worked the fields, should be the primary decision makers within the given society. After all, they are the laborers. They are part of the labor class. So why should not the labor class be the primary benefactors of what the land and society could produce, instead of some fat, you know, industrial class or planter class person who just sits on his or her behind, working the labor class and getting all the rewards and benefits. Now, this consciousness helped forge by our slave labor experience was in complete opposition to the class interest of the elites, both North and South, but in this case particularly the South, who saw the subjugation of black labor and labor in general as one of the key components. Now, though, all of a sudden, not only do you have this type of consciousness coming out from and expressing itself from black people, but at the same time, you have the enfranchisement of black people taking place, where black people can express this type of view by actually participating in the body politics, which, as I noted before, was in an extreme local level in many aspects, where you can see direct results from how you participated in a particular society at a given time. So this content of our character needed to be suppressed. It wasn't simply just oppressing us, negating our basic human rights simply because we had black skin, but because of the content of our character, the forging of consciousness by black people that was helped expressed and forged through the slave labor class realities of our experience. And now with political power challenged the slaveocracy class. And this needed to be oppressed by any and all means. these were the dynamics that black people quickly found themselves in as they were ascertaining more and more basic rights on Sam's plantation. So it was just that raw and just that real. Now continuing with Redemption. The typical fantasies you would see come out about stories being told and believed by local planters like Adolf Lassard, who said, quote, he overheard a conversation that took place one night on his plantation and was able fortunately to give warning of the premeditated diabolism. The white men were to be trapped and the women and children thus left without protection were to be captured by the dastardly wretches, meaning black folks, who proposed to, in their own words, raising a new race, a people. It goes on to this whole thing of them, quote, the shock of fool fiendish plots unnerved Mr. Lazard, the fear of their fulfillment haunted by. Today he is an inmate of an insane asylum, driven there by the foul wretches whose atrocities led to the Battle of Colfax. His mental death, together with the blood of the slain, lies at their doors. Unquote. Now, in reality, this was all fantasy. This is just rhetoric. There was no attempt to kill off white men, kidnap their daughters and wives, and quote-unquote create a new race of people, meaning a mixed race of people. But what's kind of fascinating about this is while Grant is writing this rhetoric in her book, there already existed in Louisiana a well-established Creole slash mulatto population just across the river from Colfax, where Kate Grant lived. These were mixed race, quote unquote, Louisiana people, but they were born of black women in the white dominant slaveocracy fathers. The nightmare, the true nightmare, had been on the other side of the coin. But see, in this racialized fantasy that whites often engaged in, well, reality was not to be dealt with. Continuing on, quote, in 1875, General Philip Sheridan, the great Union cavalryman of the Civil War, was sent to Louisiana by President Grant to try to restore order. He made a careful investigation and reported that since the end of the war, 2,141 Negroes had been killed by whites in Louisiana and 2,115 wounded. All these crimes again and again going unpunished. Henry Adams and his committee concluding that the free slaves could not safely live amongst their former masters formed a, quote, colonialization council, unquote, and wrote to President Grant asking to be given land where they could settle and live in peace by themselves. The anti-Negro violence was an expression of racial hatred intertwined with and intensified by political conflict. Adams later testified before a U.S. Senate. Now let me stop right there for a sec. Once again, what you have is a situation where the conflict black people found themselves in can't be undermined. And what I mean by that is that while the Civil War was over the issue of slavery, it was not over the issue of black liberation and or black human emancipation. And I know that sounds like contradictory terms, but this is basically what I mean. See, in the North, you had a developing, powerful, industrial class of white elites. And their vision of America and its developing future was that of it being an industrialized society. Not just a raw material producing society, but actually a society where it manufactured its goods and thus was able to compete with European industrialists. See, remember, what became America was established by British colonialists, and they set up the American economy to basically be an exporter of raw material. And that's primarily what the South was. See, in the South, you had a plantation class, a planter's class, that basically just produced and made their wealth off of the production of raw material. They didn't manufacture it. They weren't into steel, railroads, and all of that type of stuff. They were like an elite class of raw material producers in a similar situation where you see much of Africa and the Middle East in a constant state of like third worldism, where the regions are just producers of raw material, hydrocarbons, cobalt, uranium, but they don't manufacture it there. They don't refine it there. And as the industrialists in the North saw this as being in, from an elite capitalist standpoint, a permanent stage of servitude to more powerful capitalists. Now, the Southern slaveocracy had historically been the dominant power, political power in the country. But as the Northern elite white class was emerging, they wanted to challenge the course of elite history and projection of the Americas. The dynamic would keep rising up, though, was that the America of today had not fully been developed in the 1860s. In essence, while in the North, the South, and the East, the Native Aboriginals had been disciplined properly, i.e. exterminated, their land taken from them, completely disenfranchised, the remaining thrown on reservations, destroyed much of their cultural identity, i.e. neutralized. In the West, you had Crazy Horse, Two Moon, Touch the Clouds, Rain in the Face, Sitting Bull, Gaul, Cape Big Head, on and on, which basically represented territory that was still in the hands of Native Aboriginals. Both sides knew that the onward expansion of the U.S. white elite idea was going to challenge the Aboriginal natives for their land. In other words, they would have to be exterminated for the greater expansion of white dominance. But this would bring up a touchy issue, because in each area that would be conquered, a new state would form. And would it be a state under the influence of the Republican Party, i.e. the party that was in alignment with the industrial class of the North, bankers, railroads, steel, or would it be in alignment with the Democratic Party, the slaveocracy class, which would perpetuate the slaveocracy's influence and expand the system of slavery that went with that class affiliation and construct. So what you basically ended up having was two elite white classes, white industrial elite classes in the capital model, and white elite planter class in the slaveocracy model. Conflict over the new course of America. So this exploded out into what became the Civil War. So even though it was over the issue of slavery, it wasn't over the issue of black human emancipation. It was over the issue of whose class vision would be the course of the emerging America. So what ended up happening was the industrial class ended up winning out on that level, on that particular topic. In other words, the new expanding states as a result of the Civil War would not be slave states, and thereby the development of industrial dominance under their wage base, you know, subjugation system would be the dominant form of production and relationship in post-Civil War America. But that led, but there was, that didn't mean that black people had to be in any way free as human beings in their given region. Now, of course, it did create enough the Civil War itself created enough human contradictions and personal dynamics that it opened up an opportunity. But it wasn't because elite white industrialists were somehow all of a sudden sympathetic to black folks, you know, issues and stuff, because they were busy exploiting their workers in the North themselves under a wage slave system. But what ended up happening is it's on one or a couple of levels, and one is this raw and personal. See, back then, if you were many of the people who were into politics, who became senators, congressmen, back in the day, in the 1800s and stuff like that, their behinds were out on the battlefield also. It wasn't like it is today with Boy George and Cheney and all these bozos and stuff, never picking up a gun except to, you know, shoot at each other when they're supposedly hunting for little pigeons and stuff. But back then, you know, many of the senators and so on and so forth were actually out on the battlefield. So if you were a Republican fighting for the Union out on the battlefield, there's no doubt that there's a good chance that you lost friends, that you may have lost a brother, that your mom may have died while you were out on the battlefield, and her last request was to see you, but you didn't even know about it, her death, until months later, so you didn't even get to bury your own mom. Quite often, you see people with missing arms, lost eyes, who were, you know, congressmen and senators and stuff like that. So now it's personal. Now it's personal, because the people that you fought against, you do consider enemies. You know, because it takes on a personal dynamic role and stuff. And then you know that 200,000 black folks picked up the gun for their own agendas. But nevertheless, that helped the Union crush the South. So there's some sympathy towards. This is why Lincoln said himself that, well, at least the black people who won picked up the gun, you know, with soldiers, that they, at least as men, should have a right to vote. And then also educated, you know, black people who were not slaves in America but were free men, educated, these elites should have a right to vote. So you had that dynamic on a personal level take place. And then also political opportunism, because many of them quickly realized that in many places in the South, South Carolina, Mississippi, the blacks were the majority of the population. And quite naturally, black people were going to be sympathetic towards the Republican Party. Well, this would give Republicans even more influence in the body politics and a lockhold now also in the southern states. So they would have all kinds of political opportunity for themselves, you know, going to the South, becoming elected officials, and also politics was directly then and now related to economics and so on and so forth. So these dynamics took place that gave black people some mobility and somewhat being players in the dynamic of the post Civil War era. But the shadow, as I'm trying to point out, that hovered over all of this that needs to be emphasized, at least to me, is that the issue of black emancipation, especially by the elite whites of industry, was not the primary focus of it. It was about a class battle of elitism about what form of elite political domination was going to be the course of American history. The planters' slaveocracy system that was just a raw material producing system that would, you know, they would ship the material out to the North, they would ship it out to Europe, basically, you know, in just under the same little, the British colonialist model, or the industry of the North vision, where they saw themselves being more powerful players. And this is why in the North, they were intentionally protecting their markets, putting up high tariffs so that the goods that were produced in Europe were higher than the goods produced in America, you know, furniture and things like that, so that they can develop their own industry. So, these were the dynamics that were exploded out. And this is the dynamic that black people and the contradiction that black people have found themselves in, and what I think is often misunderstood when people in general simply to say, well, quote unquote, Lincoln freed the slaves, quote unquote, or, you know, these kind of cliches about the Civil War, freeing the slaves, and this and the Civil War being about the issue of slavery on a simplistic level that doesn't get into the dynamics of the class interest and how that would end up playing out once the Reconstruction period ended. Now, while these dynamics were playing out in the political sphere, in part because of the thrust of the for autonomy of black folks during the post-Civil War years, in 1865, General Sherman made his special field order, number 15 proclamation. It was basically 40 acres and a mule for black people. and the role that they had played in the dynamics of the Civil War, and for the treachery of the planter class in trying to secede from the Union, and going to war against the Union. So let's hear Eric Foner describe some of these events that took place under this Special Field Order 15 proclamation by Sherman.
"40 Acres and a Mule" is one of the few things that most people have heard of from the Reconstruction period, maybe because it's the name of Spike Lee's film company or something like that. But it was a slogan widely disseminated during Reconstruction. It originated in this order that General Sherman issued, William T. Sherman, in January 1865, after he had occupied the city of Savannah, and he met with a group of black ministers there and basically said to them, look, your people are now free. What do you need to be really free people? And they basically said, we need land. You can't be a genuinely free person in the United States in an agricultural society without owning land. Otherwise, you're going to be dependent on other people. You won't be truly free. By the way, Thomas Jefferson had said pretty much the same thing, 60 years earlier, but of course he was only talking about whites, not blacks. And in response to that, Sherman said, okay, there's all this land along the coast of South Carolina and Georgia. The planters have fled. There's a lot of blacks there. I'm going to divide this land into 40-acre plots for black families. And in the next few months, several thousand black families, maybe 40 or 50,000 people altogether, were settled on what was called Sherman land. They got their 40 acres, and the Army also gave them mules. The Army had an enormous number of mules carrying stuff around. And this sort of symbolized the hope and belief of the former slaves that they would get land, that this would be part of their freedom, would be access to some kind of economic independence. But of course it didn't happen. President Andrew Johnson, who came into power, came into office as soon as Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, Johnson was a racist Southerner, and he very quickly ordered all that land given back to the former owners. And he sort of stopped right at the beginning of Reconstruction. He stopped this process of redistributing land. One of the tragic things that happens in that period is toward the end of 1865, the very same Union Army that had distributed land to some of these former slaves now comes back and tells them, look, you got to get off the land now. President Johnson has restored it to the former owners. You can stick around if you want, but you have to acknowledge the former owners own the land, and you have to sign a labor contract to work as a laborer on the land, but it's not your land anymore. And people who refused to accept that were evicted from the land by the Union Army. And this, of course, led to a tremendous sense of betrayal. You know, in the 1930s, many, many years after this, the WPA, one of the New Deal, projects, interviewed former slaves, and these slave narratives are widely available now. And one of the things that a lot of these very elderly then people still remembered was the sense of betrayal after the Civil War. And they said, you know, we were promised land by the government, and then they took it away from us. And that lingered long after the end of the Civil War and Reconstruction.
So once again, you can see the dynamics that were quickly emerging within the body of politics. Here you have a situation where, you had at least 40,000 black people on this land with 40 acres and a mule working the land. And this was some of the autonomy that was essential for any people under these types of conditions to try to ascertain some forms of basic human survival mode. But Lincoln gets killed, Andrew Johnson, president, sympathetic to the South, has the black folks kicked off the land. And this, of course, is not an issue to the industrialist class, the real power brokers, because for them, like I said, while the Civil War was over slavery, it was over the expansion of slavery in the form of economic structure that America was going to be under. A chattel slave, slaveocracy class, or a wage-based slave capital mode of domination. The Civil War settled that aspect. So black people being ripped from basic human rights and from the land that had been promised and distributed to them could be something that a Republican president could get away with, because it wasn't really challenging on the real the issue of the industrial class that they represent. They weren't challenging that. So this is some of the dynamics that I'm trying to illuminate, and the severe crisis black people found themselves in. So as these things play themselves out, you have a dynamic where continuing on with the redemption and what was developing in Colfax, it goes like this. In February 1874, a federal court began to hear the Colfax case, but it ended in a mistrial. The unacceptability of the idea of convicting whites for killing blacks can be adduced from the white prosecutor's apologetic summation to the jury. Quote, "This is the first time, and God's grant it may be the last, that all testimony has been from colored men. Aside from their lack of intelligence, I was apprehensive that by their aggressive sense of wrong and their disposition to exaggerate, a vindictive feelings might be manifested. But of all the witnesses placed on that stand and confronted with their murderers, not one of them manifested in any instance the degree of malice that a white man would. I confess, I don't understand." So here again, here you see this mentality of basically, what the hell are black people doing testifying? And look at them with their aggressive sense of being wrong, you know, because their people were being slaughtered systematically. And then he couldn't see white people doing it, even though he knew this was going on systematically in the states that he's from himself. So once again, you see these dynamics playing themselves out. And the continuing developments taking place. As here, Eric Foner explains the continuing developments of the Civil War that emerged, the components of civil rights, which were clearly being challenged by terrorist tactics.
The Civil Rights Bill of 1866, which is actually still on the books today, over a century later, is one of the most critical laws ever passed by Congress. It's vetoed by Johnson, but then with two-thirds of the Congress, they repassed it. In fact, it was the first significant piece of legislation ever passed over the veto of a president. And this bill did several key things. First of all, it declared that black people were citizens of the United States. Now, you might say, well, obviously they're citizens. They're born here, whatever. But the law of the land at that time was that no black person could be a citizen. That was the Dred Scott decision of 1857 of the Supreme Court, which was still the law of the land. That the Supreme Court had ruled that only a white person could be a citizen of the United States. So this law created black citizenship, and in fact it said that anybody born in the United States is a citizen of the United States. And so it applied not only to African Americans, but to people from Asia or anywhere else, immigrants born here, they automatically become citizens. But more than that, it then created this, for the first time in the law, this principle of equality among citizens, regardless of race. In other words, that all these citizens are to enjoy the same legal rights. Now, it didn't apply to the right to vote, which states could regulate, but all sorts of other things. I mean, access to court, testifying, signing contracts, enjoying the fruits of your labor. This law really is the origin in our laws of the principle of civil rights, which today we take for granted. In other words, that all people ought to enjoy the same legal rights regardless of race. But that principle didn't exist before the Civil War. There was no state in the Union, North or South, that gave African Americans what we would consider full legal equality. And so the civil rights law was a tremendously important redefinition of what race relations were supposed to be in the United States.
So once again, you can see how the various dynamics of the Civil War produced many of these elements that created certain forms of rights and autonomy in basic human survival type of modes that black people were trying to expand and seize upon. The humanizing, at least on paper, laws that were being written had nothing, weren't coming out of some great American character, but they were out of the political dynamics of conflict within the given society by elite forces that the masses, or at least elements of the masses, or especially black people, tried to take advantage of. It's quite ironic that, you know, most whites in the South didn't know how to read, because most whites in the South were not the planter class. They were just poor whites on the poorest land, because why would the white planters had the best land, and they didn't really need to educate or have any kind of real educational system for the whole of their society, because it was just a raw material producing agricultural land base. So with the crushing of the South, at least temporarily, as a result of the Civil War and the emerging of a black electorate that was pushing for new autonomy, this is how schools and stuff that could be that could be experienced by all, including white poor people, now could take advantage of. So more whites ended up getting educated in the South themselves during the post-war Civil War period than were educated during slavery, during the pre-Civil War period. So in many ways, many whites were emancipated by the result of the Civil War. But psychologically, because of them being tied to the construct of whiteness, and through that, they look through the world through elite white lenses, because whiteness is a construct of elite white males. They ended up going against the black masses, whose very dynamic and condition had more to do to liberate them than anything that the planter class could ever conceive of. The contradictions are enormous. Then and now. It also should be noted, with the Civil Rights Bill of 1866, that was based around the black issue and the role that black people made in the political push that was going on post the Civil War, that this opened it up for more people in general. In other words, immigrants could now become citizens, where in the past, your citizenship was based off of, were you white or not? You know? So the issue had benefits, quote unquote, for all groups of people, that I think many, especially in America, need to start to understand more forthrightly. But here, now Fauner goes into how President Andrew Johnson tried to argue against the various rights, like the 14th Amendment. So let's check this out.
Johnson said, first of all, that it's up to the states to determine what the rights of individuals are. The Congress should not tell states how to treat their various citizens. And in a way, that was the traditional view. Before the Civil War, your basic rights came from the states. But the Civil War had so empowered the national government and had developed this sense of nationalism and identification with the federal government in the North that people now said, like Charles Sumner, the great senator from Massachusetts, said, look, the federal government has freed the slaves. Now it must become the custodian of their freedom. In other words, it has to protect the rights of the people who have become free. Johnson also was just a racist. He said, you know, black people don't understand what it is to be a citizen in this country. Basically, he just said black people are inferior. They can't enjoy the same basic legal rights of citizenship of whites. And so the two appeals of Johnson, to states' rights and to racism, in a sense, laid down the basic arguments against black justice, which would be repeated over and over again all through the late 19th and even well into the 20th century. I mean, you can see Johnson's arguments in the arguments against the Brown versus Board of Education decision, or against the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You know, he laid down the anti-civil rights arguments, which get repeated over and over again through, you know, much of the rest of our history.
So once again, of course, Johnson would not be saying this type of stuff if it directly contradicted the interest of the industrial class in the North, which he, as a Republican, represented. But even though black people were basically Republicans in the South, he can go against it because it's his class racialized alliance as a white man in alliance with white elitism can serve both the interest in the post-Civil War era, the white industrialist class, which he was serving as, you know, someone who would give protections to the railroad, you know, subsidies and all of that type of stuff, but at the same time help curtail black people's rights in the South to benefit the former slaveocracy class of white planters, and to help re-in-bondage black folks without any contradiction at all. because what he is serving is the elites of the society. And since the issue of the expansion of chattel slavery had been resolved, he can do both at the same time. So these are the dynamics, once again, that black folks found themselves in this horrific society. Now, continuing on with redemption. Some combination of outrage that the federal government had dared to try to punish the perpetrators of the Colfax massacre and of a sense of invulnerability because the effort had failed thus far emboldened white Louisianans. By now, it was an election year again, and that presented the alluring possibility of inflicting a crushing, undisputed defeat on the Republicans. On March 28, 1874, only a few miles from Colfax in Alexandria, three former Confederates officers started a newspaper called The Caucasian, which was dedicated to the proposition that it was time for white supremacy to be reestablished by force in Louisiana. As an early editorial put it, quote, "We having grown weary of tame submission to this most desolating war of the Negro upon us, propose to take a bold stand to assert the dignity of our manhood, to say in tones of thunder and with the voice of angry elements, stop, thus far shall thou go, and no further," unquote. The advent of the Caucasian led quickly to the appearance of similar sentiments in newspapers all over the state. Within a month, a group of whites had convened in another Red River town, Opulas, and established a new organization called the White League. Nearly overnight, the White League became a substantial statewide operation. Many Confederate veterans in Louisiana, as elsewhere in the South, had never fully accepted the outcome of the Civil War, if that was defined as full citizenship for the former slaves, and they had continued the conflict locally, informally, and sporadically through the Ku Klux Klan and similar mystical titled terrorist organizations. The leading one in Louisiana was called the Knights of the White Camellia. The White League was something more. It was less secret, better organized, and more explicitly political in its aims. Its purpose was to use extra-legal violence to remove the Republican Party from power, and then to disenfranchise black people. Although it drew emotional substance from the old idea that it was protecting white womanhood from that black despolitization and trying to restore the proper order of the races, it maintained activities where in the public realm. It tried to drive Republican office holders out of power, to disrupt Republican campaign activities, and to prevent Negroes from voting, all aims that were to be accomplished by any means necessary. The risk of being Republican in Louisiana was escalating so quickly that even William Ward soon renounced his membership in the party. As one historian aptly put it, the White League was, quote, the military arm of the Democratic Party, unquote. Let me stop there for a sec. So once again, you have a terrorist operation that is basically doing a lot of the assassinations, kidnappings, brutalizations of targeted individuals who are engaged in political in the political process. At the same time, the other wing of it, the Democratic Party, puts on the good face, the veneer. They have elected officials who go and do speeches. It's similar to how the U.S. Empire today as a whole creates various terrorist subgroup operations for covert operations and so on and so forth, and how they use their CIA to go and destabilize societies, how they create Mujahideen networks and all of that, Al-Qaeda and so on and so forth, while the raggedy Democrats and Republicans put on the good face and veneer as they, you know, stand all suited up in their little business suits and dresses and stuff to give the image of a civilized society, where behind the curtains, the raw, naked brutality of the beast is showing its horns and fangs to the masses that are on the ground, whether they're in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Congo, or Louisiana and Mississippi and other regions of the South during Reconstruction time. So some of the same techniques are just now more fully developed and operational on an international scale. Continuing on, in May 1874, a second trial of the Colfax prisoners in New Orleans resulted in a victory for them that only increased white Louisiana's sense of possibility. An Associated Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Joseph Bradley, came to New Orleans to attend the trial, and after the verdict came in, 5 acquitted, 3 convicted, he ruled that the Enforcement Act of 1870, under which the convictions had been obtained, were unconstitutional. He had all the prisoners released, not just the 5 acquitted, but the 3 convicted as well in Colfax. The whites celebrated at a mass meeting after, which white men went out into the countryside to terrorize Negroes. They slit the throats of 2 black men without provocation and left them lying dead on the ground. Once again, the U.S. Army had to come to apprehend the murders in lieu of functioning local criminal justice system, but the suspects were released because no Negroes would testify against them. Let me stop right there for a sec. What's the point in testifying when you knew that the outcome was going to be just like it was the last time, and you were just going to get assassinated? You were going to be put on the list. This is how terrorism works, and how it was just colluded with the raggedy U.S. Supreme Court justices and all that type of stuff. But see, once again, this goes back to what I was saying about the whole issue of the Civil War issue between North and South was over the issue of slavery, but not black emancipation and liberation. There is a difference. Now, continuing on with the redemption. Louisiana's Republican governor later said that the acquittal of the Colfax prisoners was regarded as establishing the principle that hereafter no white man could be punished for killing a Negro. The federal government appealed the case to the Supreme Court. On the 48th anniversary of the Colfax massacre, April 13, 1921, the white townspeople of Colfax erected a monument, a white marble obelisk, placed at the most prominent location in the town cemetery to commemorate the most dramatic day in their local history. Engraved on the shaft were the words, "In loving remembrance, erected to the memory of the heroes." Steve Dakar Parrish, James West Hadnock, Sidney Harris, who fell in the Colfax riot fighting for white supremacy, April 13, 1873. So, once again, this is open. It's clear what the savages are up to. Now, while this madness took place and took hold, this helped expand the range of terror in other regions of the South. Continuing on redemption. Like other Confederate states, Mississippi had, just after the war, with the tactic encouragement of President Andrew Johnson, convened a legislature made up mainly of unrepentant Confederates, and it had passed black codes, quote-unquote, that legislated the free slaves into a condition as close to their former one as it was possible to get without actually reinstituting slavery. The Mississippi codes essentially prohibited Negroes from renting land or quitting their jobs. The object was to force them to remain as plantation hands instead of becoming independent farmers, and also restrict their rights of assembly and voting. in retaliation for its failure to ratify the 14th Amendment, the Republican U.S. Congress, which had impeached President Johnson over his open sympathy for white South, had refused to resubmit Mississippi to the Union as a state. That is why it was still under federal control. So you can see the dynamics that were happening. And you had what were called many radical Republicans who were infuriated by the tactics that were going on in Colfax, Louisiana, in Mississippi, in the President Johnson and all of that type of stuff, and his, you know, open sympathy and stuff with the slave class. So these things were being played out within the dynamic of the Reconstruction period. Now, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. The 14th gave civil rights. The 15th gave voting rights. So, slavery, the 13th Amendment was basically off the table for the South. They knew that with the result of the Civil War, they couldn't bring that back. But curtailing the 14th Amendment, i.e. the civil human rights, and the 15th Amendment, the voting rights, was now essential for white supremacy to reign again in the South for the planter class. So these are the dynamics that were developing quickly, continuing on. In January 1868, under the supervision of occupying federal troops, a Mississippi version of another Southern institution of the time, a black and tan convention, in a case with 68 white and 17 Negro delegates, convened in Jackson to write a new state constitution in which freedmen's rights would be protected fully enough to persuade Congress that Mississippi could become a state again. The convention produced a constitution in May 1868, but a month later, because of white intimidation of black voters, it failed to win the approval of more than half the theoretically black majority Mississippi electorate. After the election, General Grant, then Secretary of War, preparing to run for president, appointed Adelbert Ames provisional governor of Mississippi. In March 1869, on the day after Ames was inaugurated as governor in Jackson and Grant was inaugurated as president in Washington, the latter gave the former the additional title of commander of the 4th Military District. Ames' main assignment was to supervise, with the backing of a new president, who seemed prepared to be much tougher on the former Confederates than his predecessor had been. A fall election in which Mississippi would approve the new state constitution, accept the new federal 14th and 15th constitution amendments, which guaranteed Negro civil and voting rights, and elected state officials, after which it would at last be readmitted to the United States. In late October, a few days after the election, Ames reported to his supervisors in Washington that the troops under his command were mainly engaged in putting down violence that was aimed at the two goals, which were actually one goal, of suppressing Negro rights and preventing the Republican victory that a truly open election would almost certainly entail. He wrote, quote, "By the numerous reports at this headquarters, it appears that the disturbances and lawlessness have been origins in political animosity, and the incapacity or unwillingness of many to recognize the change resulting from the latter late war and the condition of the freed people. Quote, a prevailing sentiment in many sections of the state has been that the whites who entertain political sentiments different from the community should be driven therefrom, and that the blacks should be, if not deprived of their rights, undeniably theirs by the law, at least seriously curtailed in the exercise of them." Of course, Ames was himself one of those whites who entertained political sentiments different from the community. In the parlance of the former Confederacy, he was a carpetbagger, and as such, he belonged to a class whose members Southern whites supposed were motivated by anything but idealism. So basically what you have is the developing strategy of neutralizing and killing off anyone that would support black people's rights and black people's expression of their rights through the vote and their idea of a new America. The reason why I pointed out some of the contradictions that black people found themselves in with their new vision or their different vision is that in many ways this was threatening not to not just to the slaveocracy class in the South, but the industrial class, especially if black people had gained more and more strength politically, which was easily foreseeable given the fact of the high concentration of black people in the South and the incredible number of skills that the black slave laborers, former slave laborers, had had. In other words, black people who weren't just in the agricultural systems, but, you know, like people like Frederick Douglass built ships. Others were the architects and builders of buildings, homes, et cetera, bridges. So if this was allowed to stay in the hands of the control of the labor, in the hands of black people who were obviously coming from a more communal sense, you would have a different type of political vision that not only was challenging to the slaveocracy planter class of the South, but the industrial class in the North as well. Continuing on with the redemption. The country then was lustily political. Newspapers were unapologetically party organs. Other than a few major railroad companies, which were new, there was not much big business or organized labor to counterweight government. Let me stop for that. There was money influence that was enormous. And the big business, the railroads, they were spraying money into the hands of openly of congressmen, senators, to get the policies and things like that, the tariffs, the subsidies, the homestead-like acts for their interests that they wanted. There's absolutely no doubt about that, which was later to develop into the super domination of the money class in the Gilded Age. Continuing, there was no federal civil services. Rich super special interest groups were only beginning to manifest themselves in politics, to the shock of the nation, and the lack of them meant that the parties were all powerful. Although the federal government was small, the army was the only federal agency, quote unquote, in the modern sense, which was why it was running the Freedmen's Bureau in the South. It controlled much of the country's landmass, as well as such vital matters in a society of farmers, shopkeepers, and craftsmen, as tariffs and the amount of public currency in circulation. Economically well-off people who were in such businesses as railroads, bonds, foreign trade, and mining depended completely on government favor. A government job or a contract was a precious thing and obtainable solely through political influence. So much was at stake in politics that just about everyone who could vote did. Campaigning was a mass popular activity. Office holders were celebrities who had the oratorial skill to hold a crowd's attention for hours. Getting the right to vote was quite literally, as Ames reported, a matter of life and death, at least in Mississippi. Many forms of political maneuvering and intrigue short of violence were available to the forces opposing Reconstruction in the South, though that certainly didn't mean violence was a constant possibility or that the former Confederates considered it wrong. So you can see these dynamics playing out and why I was emphasizing the politics aspect during those times in such a regional situation, especially in like areas like Mississippi, were so crucial for black people to gain some kinds of rights. Continuing, as freshman senators are supposed to do, Ames waited a suitably long time until March 21st, 1871. Before making his maiden speech, it was a brief in support of one of a series of what were popularly known as Ku Klux Laws, or Force Acts, providing for federal, meaning U.S. Army, enforcement of Negro civil and voting rights in the South in cases where the local authorities would not enforce them. The federal prosecution of violators of the 14th and 15th Amendment. Ames knew that Mississippi Ku Kluxes were trying by means up to and including murder to keep the Negroes from organizing and voting and to drive carpetbaggers out of the state. He warned his colleagues that they should not assume that the Civil War had been entirely ended in the South. Hatred to the Union, treason, cannot be wiped out of men. Defeats, disasters, and humiliations are not likely to generate love for the government. The country makes a sad and grievous mistake when it supposes that all the evils of slavery and rebellion vanished on that day of surrender at Appomattox Courthouse. He complained in particular that Governor Alcorn, whose claims that he was vigorously pursuing the Mississippi Ku Kluxers were belied by a total lack of results. In a second speech delivered the following month, Ames reported that during Alcorn's governorship, 30 Negro schoolhouses and churches in Mississippi had been burned down with no one punished for, and that in the first 3 months of 1871 alone, the Ku Klux Klan had murdered 63 Mississippi Negroes, again with complete immunity. In the fall of 1872, when Ames was next in Mississippi, he found himself regularly listening to, as politicians considering a race often do, to importuning to try for it. Mississippi Negroes, though whites saw them as the political pawns and dupes of carpetbaggers, had in fact organized themselves with impressive speed. The first formal statewide meeting of Negro Republicans had been held back in 1868 in Vicksburg. Since then, nearly every county in Mississippi had developed a strong local Negro Republican organization, which was often built on a foundation laid out by one of the leading black religious denominations, the African Methodist Episcopal, the Baptist, or the Methodist Episcopal, the Freedmen's Bureau, the Loyal League, and an informal cadre of educated Negro ministers and educators who had moved to Mississippi from the North, all helped in the project of political organization. Politically active Negroes found safety in numbers. They liked to stage parades, rallies, and to come to polling places in masses to make it less likely that white vigilantes would track them. Let me stop for a sec. One of the interesting things and dynamics that was taking place was that you started during the Reconstruction period see an influx of black people from the North who were free black people moving to the South. Why? Because many of them were already very well educated and saw political opportunity in the South, because they now saw a situation where there were strong voting blocks, strong economic opportunity for expansion of land, et cetera, et cetera. That being an influential way to change some of the dynamics of the American experiment. Continuing on. Black politics and black economics went together. And what ground Negroes were gaining in organizing and voting, they were losing in the struggle to find alternatives to plantation employment. Instead, the sharecropper system, in which Negro field hands lived on plantations, often the same ones where they had been slaves, owned no land, and split the proceeds of the cotton they raised picked with their former masters on highly unfavorable terms. Let me stop there for a sec. This once again emphasizes the dynamic of the betrayal of the 40 acres and the mule. You know, the whole 15th Section 15th proclamation that was ripped away by Andrew Jackson. So here, the elite class that went to war against the North, i.e. treason by their standards, they run from the land when they saw that their side was losing. Black folks get the land, and then black folks get kicked off the land, and the treason party class gets the land back. Only in America. Continuing. This was rapidly emerging as a dominant economic form of post-emancipation Mississippi. To escape the sharecropper system would require schools to be built, a real justice system to be established, and access to patronage jobs. And all those would be impossible unless Negroes first attained political power. That was why so many black Republicans were no longer willing to put up with the bargain Alcorn and Revelers represented, and why they turned to Ames as an alternative. It was still such an early movement of black politics that nobody could imagine a Negro winning the governorship. Ames couldn't imagine it, because even as he was beginning to see Negroes as admirable, he still saw them as simple. And most Negroes couldn't imagine it, because they thought the prospect would be so horrifying to whites as to lead to a race war that they would lose. So for now, Ames' political ambition and the political ambitions of Mississippi's bolder Negro politicians converged on the idea of his running for governorship. This just goes into the other dynamic. Black people are the majority, but they're trying to walk a fine line, because we know that if there's too many black people in political power, like in governor, that this could just set whites off into even a more violent outrage and genocidal pack with the White League and others that they were already on. So trying to align yourself with at least somewhat sympathetic politicals was the technique that that many black people found themselves in, and found themselves trying to survive within this particular situation. Now, what's also fascinating was, as I mentioned about Ames, who was the governor and who black people saw as an alternative to run in the governorship. The day Ames was elected as governor in Mississippi, Lucius Lamar, a Southern Bourbon politician, was elected to the U.S. Congress, a former Confederate general, defender of slavery, a secessionist. A Bourbon basically means he was an elite white. When Lamar took his seat in Congress, April 27, 1874, he gave a long and respectful eulogy for Senator Charles Sumner. Sumner was a well-known radical Reconstructionist. Sumner, in 1856, was clubbed unconscious by a South Carolinian congressman upset about Sumner's radicalism. Lamar gave praise to Sumner, though, and his moralism. And he featured him as a great man and suggested sectional reconciliation, which basically was saying that, you know, we should put down our anger, North and South, reconcile, so on and so forth. This speech put Lamar, the former Confederate general, in a new light in many people's mind, or the mind of the public and many of the politicals of the day. It changed him from being looked upon as the diehard Southern secessionist to a national like statesman, giving him the image of being a fusionist. You know, let's fuse our ideas together and work it out. Never mind the fact that in reality, what they're fusing is still elite white capital ideas. That fuse, basically what they're talking about is the elitism of white industrial northern worldview with the idea of the planter elite white class in the South, which meant that he was now in reality a more powerful opponent to true black emancipation and Governor Ames. Because while Lamar was playing this fusionist reconciliation card to the public, at least, the race card, with all of its implications, was where this bourbon's heart was really at. A fact that Lamar made clear in this letter he wrote to his wife weeks earlier.
You will find that his mission in Mississippi, as proclaimed by himself, is the exclusion, by means of the ballot in the hands of the freedmen, from any share in the government of the only class in which reside the elements of dignity, virtue, and the welfare of society. The real effect of his scheme is that the white people of the state shall be for 4 years longer practically denied the privilege of self-government, their voice silenced, and their interests and their honor confided to strangers who neither comprehend the one nor believe in the existence of the other. I say strangers, for General Ames admitted in his speech here that his party of northern men and enfranchised Negroes were new to the political interests and institutions of the state. Draw a line on one side of which you see property, intelligence, virtue, religion, self-respect, enlightened public opinion, and exclusion from all political control. And on the other, the absolute unchecked political supremacy of brute numbers. There you will behold not one attribute of free government, but the saddest and the blackest tyranny that ever cursed the earth. Let it be conceded, which I am always glad to do, that Ames and the men he carries into power are not corrupt personally. But it is impossible and certainly unprecedented for a body of men to be invested with such vast powers and irresponsible control over the entire wealth of a state without becoming corrupt and criminal. Where is the constituency to which these men will be responsible? Negro, it does seem to me that if there ever was a time when the white people of this state, the men in whose veins flows the blood of the ruling races of the world, should rise and with one unanimous voice protest against the domination about to be piled upon them, the present is that time. Can it be that the soul of our proud people, which a few years ago rose with such keen sense of wrong and heroic effort, has, by long oppression, been dulled into indifference and sullen despair?
So there you hear Lamar's true sentiments and the cynicalness of how he plays, and like many others, play their art of war in politics while pretending to respect this pro-reconstructionalist radical Republican Sumner in public speeches. Behind the curtain, he's talking the same type and was engaging in the same type of political activity that you would expect any component of a terrorist affiliated person to. He was just in the Democratic wing that put the good face on the body politics while his white league cohorts were out massacring. But at the end of the day, just like in today's times, it's often the men and women with the pen that kill and get killed more people than the actual people on the ground with the guns. But in the stage of where black people found themselves in the Reconstruction's end and the terrorist gangs, the colored bullets would only bring out the white bullets. So here you have Lamar talking about there was being an exclusion of the only class, meaning elite whites, where there resides elements of dignity, virtue, and welfare of society. Now, of course, this is welfare defined by elite whites, which whiteness is itself. The real effect Lamar goes into is white people for 4 more years being denied the privilege of self-government and their voice silenced and their interests confided by strangers. In other words, white supremacy had to ring out at the end of the day. Never mind all of this so-called one person, one vote, and all of that type of stuff. Then and now, look at the 2000 election. We all know that now, in now's terms especially, the whole voting thing is a sham. But it's always been a rigged campaign, and it's always been looked through racialized lens. Lamar goes on and says, draw a line on one side when you see property, intelligence, virtue, self-respect, enlightened public opinion, religion, and that's being excluded from political control. Never mind, I guess, slavery, Indian eradication, by these same elements. But for Marr and others, this wasn't a problem. It's the unchecked political supremacy of the brute members, quote unquote, and that this was the saddest, quote unquote, end quote, blackest tyranny that ever cursed the earth. So, in essence, black enfranchisement is a curse. Not slavery. This is how sick these individuals are. And when they get into political power, just like today, with the masses of the slaves, that's a horrific thing. He then goes into how in the white man's veins flows the blood of the ruling race of the world, and how it must voice protest against domination. Now, did Lamar say any of this rhetoric during the speech on the floor? No. It's just the politics of deceit. Then he goes into, can it be the soul of a proud people's keen sense of wrong and long oppression that who a few years ago rose up but now has been dulled into indifference and sullen despair? This is just saber rattling by a beast. And it just helps outline how whiteness, since it is an elite construct, overrides the aspect, because it's tied to the capital. You don't have to be an elite white, but the construct of whiteness is an elite construct. And this is how you have poor whites with not a tooth in their head and no shoes on their feet, and who became better, quote unquote, educated post-slavery, still align with whiteness over all else. And instead of white women aligning with calls for black women's voting rights to be given to them, instead, the white women of the South aligned themselves with helping destroy black males' votes to disenfranchise the people as a whole. This is, well, the American way. This has been part one of Reconstruction's End, the terrorist game, colored bullets and white bullets. We're about to move right into part two.